I'm turning now to the book of the prophet Isaiah, chapter 46 and verse 1. Isaiah chapter 46, verse 1. Bel boweth down, Nebo stoopeth. Their idols were upon the beasts and upon the cattle. Your carriages were heavy loaden. They are a burden to the weary beast. And our title is The Redeemer Revealed. Well, we've been looking through these remarkable and amazing prophecies. We've noted already in past chapters the doom of Babylon. Well, at the time of Isaiah, they had not gone into captivity in Babylon, but they would for 70 years, a discipline upon the Jewish nation at that time. And then Cyrus, who was yet unborn, emperor-to-be of the Medes and the Persians, would crush Babylon. It would be the end of the empire. And first of all, we're reading here once again about Babylon, but I'm going to make our first heading, Babylon and the End of Time. And this is a very powerful chapter, 46. Bel boweth down, Nebo stoopeth. And Bel, well, it's a name for Marduk, and Nebo also are the main, the chief, the senior gods of Babylonia. But here in the prophecy, they are crushed and their statues are being taken away in verses 1 and 2 of this chapter into captivity to serve as trophies, I suppose, in the court of the Medo-Persian Empire, that the gods of this mighty Babylonian Empire were crushed and taken. So you see here how they stoop. But there's a certain sarcasm in the inspired word given to Isaiah. The animals on which these immense statues were placed were sinking from exhaustion. They are a burden to the weary beast. And the sarcasm is here, you see, that these gods were supposed to be the upholders of Babylon, the strength of Babylon, and here they are needing to be carted away unceremoniously, quite unable, obviously, to propel themselves or to be capable of any movement, and they're a burden to the weary beast. Verse 2, they stoop, they bow down together, they could not deliver the burden. The animals can barely carry them, but themselves are gone in to captivity. So they failed and they're humiliated. But there's great significance in these verses. Now, the fall of Babylon took place, obviously, before the Israelites were able to return to their land. Cyrus came to power, and in due course, fairly speedily, there's the great Cyrus Declaration in history, the Cyrus Edict, copy of which is in the British Museum, setting free the captives and allowing them to return to their homeland. The great significance of the fall of Babylon in the history of the Bible is that it paved the way for the coming of the Messiah, because now the Israelites could be returned to their homeland and Christ could be born, not yet, but in due course, a few centuries down the line, in Jerusalem, in Judah, in accordance with all the prophecies of the past. So this is a great step. Everything seemed to have gone wrong while the Israelites were in captivity and not in their homeland, but now they're returned. But there's even greater significance, because as I mentioned, the empire fell of Babylon some little while before the release of the captives. And this event in history is in its turn a kind of prophecy of the end of the age when Christ shall come. Not all aspects of these prophecies of Isaiah are entirely satisfied or fulfilled with the fall of Babylon and the release of the captives. It's obvious that some of them look further forward to an event of which even this is a kind of pictorial prophecy, the end of the age. Now, when you consider that Babylon fell and its gods and its tokens before the return of the captives, so today's gods may be put to shame. I can't be emphatic about this, but they may be put to shame even before the return of Christ. And you think of the gods of today: evolution, rationalism and unbelief, the worship of wealth, the near worship of entertainment, the great drug that sustains everybody, debased moral conduct. These are like gods. They're so important to present society. But these gods will fall and be carted away if the event of Babylon reflects beforehand what will happen at the end. They'll actually fall and be carted away, not at, but in the run-up to and approaching the coming of Christ. And that would be quite something to witness. How could it be done? Well, of course, one can only imagine and guess. Perhaps there might be some great discovery. There have been many already, but people take no notice of them. Some great discovery that utterly routs the theory of evolution, even in the eyes of those who are so committed to it, that it becomes an utter embarrassment. And all the people who teach it and retail it are ashamed of it and can no longer utter it. And all the system of thought that binds society against God and in unbelief collapses or begins to. We see this if the end times reflect the great demonstration of God's dealing with Babylon, which we believe that it does, then you can expect something like this. The god of immoral and lewd behavior, the putting out of God's standards and the bringing in of man's corrupt opposites in the whole sexual realm. Could it be that there'd be something infinitely worse, even than AIDS, loosed upon society in the last days, so that things are seen to be shameful and utterly unnatural and unwholesome? But this seems to me, and I just mention it, but I don't want to be too dogmatic, that when you look closely at how God worked with Babylon, you might expect to see something like that in the last age scenario as we approach the end. But I must hurry. Look at verse 3. Hearken unto me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me from the belly and are carried from the womb. Well, you'll never be forsaken. You'll never be abandoned if you believe in the Lord and trust in him. And that's the sense of the passage. I'm going to move down to verse 12 of chapter 46. Hearken unto me, ye stout-hearted, that are far from righteousness, obstinate people who will not come to Christ or acknowledge God. And then verse 13 of chapter 46, I bring near my righteousness. That's what we need, a given righteousness. We cannot earn our passage to heaven. We cannot make up for our past sins. We cannot be acceptable to God by any merit or effort of our own. But God has announced, I will bring near my righteousness as a gift, ready to give it to you and freely qualify you. Salvation by grace, through faith, the gift of God. It's all here in the prophecies of Isaiah. I bring near my righteousness. It shall not be far off. It'll be proclaimed far and near. And my salvation shall not tarry. And I will place salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory, another way of saying it will all be accomplished at Jerusalem, where Christ perished and died to make an atonement for sin, where the work in the New Testament church was born. But now I pass to chapter 47, just a few verses from here, and here is a kind of lament for Babylon. But God speaks to Babylon, "Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon." She thought she was beautiful. Her city, she thought, was the finest in the world, a place of delicacies and riches, where she lived as a queen. "Sit on the ground. There is no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called tender and delicate." The words mean more refined and beautiful and rich. And verse 2, "Take the millstones and grind meal. Uncover thy locks, make bare the leg, uncover the thigh, pass over the rivers." And all that amounts to this: you're going to be very poor. This is Babylon. Your wealth and your empire will be lost, and you'll be reduced to a condition of near slavery. And everybody will be a manual laborer, and you'll haul burdens across rivers, just like the lowest in society. Verse 3, "Thy nakedness shall be uncovered, yea, thy shame shall be seen." Their immorality and their conduct will be made clear. But verse 4, "As for our Redeemer, believers in the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel." But verse 5, back to Babylon, "Sit thou silent. You'll have no visitors, no admirers, and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans," that's Babylon, "for thou shalt no more be called the Lady of Kingdoms." And then God says something here which we take note of in chapter 47 and verse 6. "I was wroth with my people." God disciplined his people for all their sin. And he allowed the Babylonians to invade them. "I have given them into thine hand," he says to Babylon. "But what did you do? Thou didst show them no mercy. Upon the ancient hast thou very heavily laid thy yoke." You were given the task, God says to Babylon. You may not have realized it, but you were given the task of bringing a discipline upon my people. And how you did it, and how cruelly you did it, and wretchedly you did it, for that you will be punished. And verse 7, and this comes very much to present society too. "And thou saidst," verse 7, "I shall be a lady forever. Nothing will ever bring me down. So that thou didst not lay these things to thine heart, neither didst remember the latter end of it." It's a kind of instinct in human beings. Even if we abandon faith in God, even if we laugh at moral values and spurn them all, it's a kind of instinct in the human being. And it runs like this: if you lead a rotten life, and a cruel life, and an immoral life, there'll be something to pay. That's in us, even in the atheist and the unbeliever. There is an instinct of discomfort about being completely wanton and abandoned. But the charge against Babylon is that she'd become so proud and so self-sufficient, so arrogant, that she'd lost that instinct, and she could be as cruel and wicked and evil as she wanted without feeling any qualms at all. "I shall be a lady forever, so that thou didst not lay these things to thy heart." But the astonishing thing is, We are seeing that now in our present society. When I was young, people had this instinct very widely, and people were just a little bit cautious. But now, people launch into things which are completely contrary to all past human values and the scripture and the Ten Commandments without any qualms. We've somehow got rid of our apprehension and fear and carefulness. We don't feel any shadow of conscience. I'm talking about unbelieving society. And people are proud of how extreme they can be. Therefore, hear now this, thou that art given to pleasures, that dwellest carelessly, which has regard to morality, abandoned moral ways, that sayest in thine heart, I am, and none else beside me. I am me. I'm accountable to no one. I shall not sit as a widow. I'll never be poor. Neither shall I know the loss of children. I'll never find myself without any satisfaction or happiness in life. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day, when God moves against a society that's become extreme. It won't know where the calamity came from. Now we're seeing just a sort of advance warning of this in the pandemic. Where did it come from? How did it start? In a laboratory? In a live animal market? In a bat's cave? How did it suddenly come to us? Why can we do nothing about it until an awful lot of people have become very, very sick and many have tragically died? It's a warning. If God takes his hand of kind control away to put us under a discipline, and when society becomes really extreme, it may have lost its fear and its instinct, but it's heading for trouble in the last days. They shall come upon thee in their perfection for the multitude of thy sorceries and for the great abundance of thine enchantments. It'll come. Verse 10, same point. For thou hast trusted in thy wickedness. Thou hast said, none seeth me. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge, it hath perverted thee. And thou hast said in thine heart, I am, and none else beside me. There's no God. There's no spiritual realm. There's no one to see me. There's no one to judge me. There's no one who can take me down. But there is. Verse 11. Therefore shall evil come upon thee. Thou shalt not know from whence it riseth, and mischief shall fall upon thee. This is not only applicable to Babylon, and it literally happened, but long term it foreshadows how God will deal with end times society. And so the prophet proceeds to tell us about these things. And I go down to verse 12. Stand thou with thine enchantments and the multitude of thy sorceries, wherein thou hast labored. If so, thou shalt be able to profit. Well, thou art wearied in the multitude of thy counsels. All your advisors cannot help you. You'll come to the end of the line, the end of the rope, and there'll be no help. And verse 15, end of the chapter 47, even the merchants, thus shall they be unto thee with whom thou hast labored, even thy merchants from thy youth. They shall wander, every one to his quarter. None shall save thee. That's very interesting. The merchants of Babylon made so much money, but when Babylon falls, or is about to fall, the merchants will evaporate. They'll disappear. They'll look for other pastures. After all, the merchants were not really ever wholehearted supporters of Babylon. They were merchants. That's where the money was. That's where the trade was. That's where the market was. They were not patriots. They were not enthusiasts. They were not for it. And when they saw that things were going down, they abandoned ship. And that's how it'll be. Even, I believe, before Christ comes, you'll see a great deal of shame in hardened, evolutionary, unbelieving society. And a lot of the people who teach it to the school children and so on, they'll abandon it. And the whole thing will be ashamed and abandoned, even in this present generation, before Christ comes again. Israel at large is dealt with in chapter 48. There's a remnant. There's a believing remnant that is faithful, and they're blessed. But Israel at large behave in a very dismal way. Chapter 48, I should proceed quickly. Hear this, ye this, O house of Israel, which are called by the name of Israel, and are come forth out of the waters of Judah, which swear by the name of the Lord, and make mention of the God of Israel. They follow the worship. They go through the ceremonies, but not in truth nor in righteousness, says Isaiah. By and large, the nation is not sincere. By and large, though they follow their religion, they're phonies. They're idol worshippers at the same time. For they call themselves of the holy city and stay themselves upon the God of Israel, the Lord of hosts, is his name. But then you see more about them, verse 4. Obstinate, their neck is an iron sinew, their brow brass, hard in face toward God. And they're condemned in the verses following because they don't listen to the Lord. There were always people like that, not only in ancient Israel, but even in the Christian churches. Today, there are people who will worship, but they will not listen to the Lord or obey. What they get out of it? Well, whatever they're looking for, it isn't really the Lord. And that's tragic. And Israel at large is described in these terms. And this 48th chapter speaks of the very small likelihood that the mass of Israelites will listen to this appeal to them made by God. A remnant will, but by no means all. But I want to come, as we move to conclusion, to the 49th chapter and a final heading, Christ now speaks. So there's been more about Babylon. There's been a chapter about the unsatisfactory conduct of the Jews at large, and now Christ is introduced and how he will appear. As the chapter goes on, it's obvious. It's the eternal Son of God, Christ, and the words are put in his mouth. Verse 1, listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from afar. One is going to come to whom the world must listen. He has come, of course, into that manger at Bethlehem to walk on earth, to suffer and die, to make an atonement for sinners who will trust in him and to rise from the dead. Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from far. The Lord hath called me from the womb. He's going to be born, literally, through a womb into the world, from the bowels of my mother. Why my mother? Why my mother? Because, of course, Christ, when he would come, wouldn't have a human father. He would be born, conceived of the Holy Spirit. Isaiah is saying only what he said before in Isaiah chapter 7. And verse 14, therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel." And now in chapter 49 and verse 1, he introduces him and his future coming. "The Lord hath called me from the womb," he says, "from the bowels of my mother." Verse 2, "He hath made my mouth like a sharp sword. I am judge of all the earth. I am the eternal Son of God," he might well say, but he's speaking of his appearance on earth. "In the shadow of his hand hath he hid me." That points to the intimate relationship between God the Father and God the Son. They're equally God, equally divine and powerful. "And made me a polished shaft." He's coming to earth in order to take the offensive against sin. "In his quiver hath he hid me," which means that just as a hunter only produces the weapon when the moment is right, so he is hidden. In the Old Testament, he's mentioned in prophecies and promises, and he isn't produced, as it were, from the quiver until he comes into the world. "And he said unto me, Thou art my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified." So he's come to be a servant. He wasn't a servant in eternity past. He isn't a servant now. He's equal with the Father and the Holy Spirit. But when he came to earth, he would be a servant, because he would be our representative, taking our place, living the perfect life we are incapable of living, to deserve heaven and glory on our behalf, suffering and dying on Calvary to bear the punishment of our sin. He came to his humiliation as a servant, though it was through him that all the worlds were made. But the mysterious words of verse 4, as Messiah, these words are put into his mouth. "Then I said, I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for naught and in vain. Yet surely my judgment is with the Lord, and my work with my God." And that amazingly describes how it would be with Christ. He would appear to fail. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. He came to redeem Israel, and by and large Israel rejected him. He appears to be taken in weakness and nailed to a cross. He appears to die, and in his human nature he does die. And so these words are put into his mouth as though he has failed. But he knows he hasn't failed. He's borne away the sins of all who would be redeemed. He's taken their punishment successfully. He'll rise from the dead and he'll rule eternally. He hasn't failed, and so he says, "My judgment is with my Father," in effect, and the Father vindicated him and accepted his offering and his suffering and death for sinners. "And now, saith the Lord," Father and Son probably speak together, "though Israel be not gathered, yet shall I be glorious in the eyes of the Lord, and my God shall be my strength." How is he going to be glorious? The Father says, "It is a light thing that thou shouldst be my servant to raise up the tribes of Israel and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the Gentiles, the whole world, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth. Thus saith the Lord, the Redeemer of Israel, and his Holy One, to him whom man despiseth, to him whom the nation abhorreth, Kings shall see and arise. Princes also shall worship because of the Lord that is faithful and the Holy One of Israel. Christ, his suffering and death on Calvary was not just for Jews, for many, many elect Jews and for many, many elect Gentiles. Now the Gentiles will come into the church and it will be Jews and Gentiles together. Not Gentiles replacing Jews, Jews and Gentiles together in the church of Jesus Christ, the last age of the earth. And if only we had time for these so beautiful words, they shall not hunger nor thirst, neither shall the heat nor sun smite them, for he that hath mercy on them shall lead them, even by the springs of water shall he guide them. Verse 12, behold, these shall come from far, and lo, these from the north and from the west, and these from the land of Sinim. And there's a great burst of praise. Thy children shall make haste, and there'll be a great harvest of souls. Well, I've just desired tonight to span some chapters to show how the prophecies of Isaiah look into the future, right into the coming of Messiah and his work and all that he does for the final age. We've looked at a little at Babylon and its application to the end of time, a little at the dismal conduct of the wider Israel as opposed to the faithful remnant. And we've seen the first speech of Christ in the prophecy of Isaiah. May God ever bless his word to our hearts. Let's close singing the hymn 478. Hymn number 478, a very searching hymn of dedication.